KGGF. I'm Matt Jordan, as we are joined every Wednesday at 7:40 and 8:10. It's the Wildcat Extension District. We've got Wendy Powell, Kenny Dotson here this morning. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I always enjoy getting to host these when I cover for James, so good to be here with both of you guys this morning, and I'll pass it over to whoever's going to start.
Sure, that'd be great. So we're going to start off with a couple of events that we've got. Even though our main season of ag meetings are winding down, we still have lots of great opportunities for learning. So I'm still taking registrations for a program called Cow Camp that is geared towards the ladies in the cattle industry. We're going to actually be doing hands-on skills work with live cattle, with out in the pasture taking forage samples. So some real hands-on learning is going to be happening there. There are 4 spots left for that learning event that will take place May 5th and 6th in Parsons. And that the cost for the program is $75, and participants get 3 meals, and they come away with tons of material and experience. So Cow Camp, May 5th and 6th in Parsons. And to sign up, you can go to our website, you can go to our social media pages, or call any of our extension offices. The Altamont number is 620-784-5337.
Awesome. And then I've also got a few things to plug. I'll plug just a few things for other people's events. Most notably coming up, we've got the nuisance wildlife control in your home, farm, and garden. So this is going to be all the topics about, you know, your squirrels and your moles and your voles and your deer. We're inviting Drew Ricketts, our wildlife specialist from campus, down. He'll be talking at the Independence Extension office, the new office, which is 712 West Myrtle, on May 9th. Let me confirm with Facebook. I thought it was May 19th, but I could be wrong. That does say May 9th at 9 a.m. So it's a morning meeting at the new Independence office. You can call at 620-784-5337, but there's no fee for that one. Just come and learn about how to control all those critters in your yard, and hopefully you can. And then I've also got some stuff to plug. We've got a Spring Crops Field Day, Tuesday, May 19th, at the Southeast Extension Center right outside of Parsons, or the north boundary of Parsons. We'll have a lot of our agronomy people from campus talking about stuff, as well as our own James Coover. They're going to talk about intercropping, alfalfa fertility, grain bin conditioning, and wheat variety plot tours. It's kind of the highlight when they get to tour all the different wheat plots. So if you're wondering about the crops in our area, come to the Southeast Research Extension Center May 19th. At 8:30 a.m. and it goes until 1. And then personally, I've got a plant-to-plate camp. Me and Catherine Pinto are hosting a camp every year where we cover about 3 days. We have kiddos from 3rd to 6th grade. We teach them about cooking, but also how to grow the plants that you're cooking. So they'll start off the morning learning about different plants, how to garden, some essentials and some basics as well. They'll get a plant to take home, and then they'll learn how to cook that plant. So first day is usually tomatoes, and then peppers, and then squashes. So they'll get to take home a pepper, a tomato, and then eventually, I think it's a zucchini this year. So come bring your kids. They'll leave with a plant and some recipes. The cost is $15, and the 2 open camps for that program are going to be Independence is still open. Once again, that's the new building at 712 West Myrtle, not the old building. That one goes from June 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. They all start at 9 a.m. And then Altamont is also open. So if you want to come to the Altamont Community Building, which is by the pool, you can sign up for that one. Also $15, also 9 a.m. They'll learn about plants, they'll cook the plants, they'll take plants home, and hopefully have a really good time. And I think that's all I got.
Well, you did mention our new building a couple of times there, and we are going to have an open house for that new building, 712
West Myrtle.
Thank you. 712 West Myrtle. May 13th, we're going to have an open house event there at the new building, so folks can come and check out the new facility. We've got some really great layouts there for learning and after business hours learning as well. So May 13th in the afternoon. I don't have the exact times, but it's an open house, so come and go type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Sometime before 6 p.m. Ooh, not before 6 a.m. So okay. I think anywhere from 3 to 6. I don't know.
There you go. May 13th. Write that down.
Mm-hmm.
All right. All right, so what are we talking about this morning?
Well, I was going to mention cleaning our stock tanks. We are getting into summertime, and that brings our perfect weather, perfect storm of stock tanks getting yucky and that green algae in them. So not only is that that green algae is enhanced by our warmer weather, but also when livestock drink from that water, sometimes they'll have grass in their mouth or grain stuck to their nose or anything like that, and so that falls into the tank, and those added nutrients to the water feed that algae. So it's really important as livestock owners and livestock caretakers to get those tanks clean, keep them clean, and make for sure that our animals are getting healthy water. So the water is our animals' most consumed nutrient. It's their most important thing that they consume. And so water quality is incredibly important. When we're talking about cattle, research has shown time and again that calves nursing cows that drink from clean stock tanks are much healthier and they gain better. So we know for sure that this protocol, keeping our water sources clean, is very beneficial. It is worth the time and effort. So speaking of cattle, they'll drink anywhere from 7 to 30 gallons a day. And so that's going to depend on temperature, their size, and of course what they're eating as well. So if they're eating a higher water content forage, then they'll probably drink a little less. But if they're eating a lot of hay, then they'll consume more water. So it's that offset right there. So like I said, summer brings the perfect storm for algae growth, sunlight on that water, warm temperatures, and then the nutrients left from the livestock drinking the water. So all of that combined enhances the algae growth. And most algae is harmless. It just clouds the water. It's not quite as pleasant, may have a bad taste for it, but we do have a few algaes in our area that could be dangerous, and we like to keep an eye out for those, and that's a blue-green algae. And it's pretty rare that we would see those in a stock tank, but it could happen, especially if livestock have access to ponds and stock tanks, so they can go back and forth. So just be aware that we could have those happening. So how do we keep our stock tanks clean? Well, the easiest thing to do is to drain those, the tanks, if they have a drain hole, and then scrub them out really well with a bleach solution, and go ahead and use that scrub brush so you actually get all of the cracks and crevices cleaned up. And that needs to be done at the beginning of the summertime and anytime that algae growth gets out of hand. But once or twice a year is the main goal there. It's much easier to keep a tank clean than it is to try to start from the beginning with a really dirty tank. So if the tank does not have a drain hole on it, then go ahead and let the livestock drink it down to a manageable level there, and then you can dump it, ideally, would be the thing to do there. So unscented household bleach is your friend there. So just make a nice little solution, scrub those edges, scrub the sides into the crevices, make for sure that it's good and clean, and then refill it with that good healthy water.
So when you're cleaning something, usually the recommendation for like a lot of chemicals is a good triple rinse. And also I wondered if there is any, you know, soap. Or I know bleach pretty much does the job, but anything else? Any other recommendations?
So on the triple rinsing, we don't want to use a bleach solution that's too harmful. Mm. We just want to be able to kill all of that algae. And so it depends on how big that stock tank is and how big you can manage your mud hole. But yes, triple rinsing is a good idea to make sure all that bleach solution is out of there. But you have to manage that with your wastewater as well.
Mm-hmm. Any soap or just bleach?
I would recommend bleach to kill the algae. Soaps, you might leave a residue from the sticky soap, and it might be on the sides, and you wouldn't want your livestock drinking that.
Mm-hmm.
A good question.
What about, you know, still water obviously is its own deal with creating bacteria and whatnot. Is there anything out there that maybe stimulates the water, so it's kind of constantly moving tank-wise, or is maybe that's just a little overkill and just making sure it's full and clean enough is good enough?
Sure. So a lot of our livestock tanks will have a float system connected to like a water hose or some underground pipe, and that's what keeps the tank full. But you can also combine that with an aerator, and that does keep the air moving. A lot of tanks that might have goldfish in them, that would also help too. Goldfish can help keep that tank clean, keep some algae eaten down. In the wintertime, we like to use those water movers, the aerator or anything that keeps the water rippling to keep it from freezing. But in the summertime, that would also help with keeping it clean as well. Yeah, great ideas.
And then I'm sure tank placement is important as well.
Yes. So anytime that you can minimize some of that sunlight on the tank, that is helpful. But also making for sure that it's not under trees so that there's not leaves falling into the tank, things like that. So make for sure that there's not going to be just stuff falling in there that needs to be cleaned out more often. But if you can put a shade or a cover over it, that's helpful. There's a lot of different types of watering systems on the market these days. I had already mentioned some winter protocols, but the freeze-proof waterers, most of them, a lot of them will have like this ball top thing that livestock will have to push down to get to the water. And so those sorts of systems also minimize the debris that falls into the tank as well as the sunlight that falls in there. So yes, absolutely. Wherever the tank sits matters just as much.
And then I'm assuming you want to have, I know we talked a lot about cattle, but specific tanks for specific livestock. You don't want those really low to the ground tanks for maybe horses and cattle because they're going to get into those tanks, mm-hmm. and then that's a whole nother mess.
Absolutely. Well. Yes, we can talk a lot about that. So the size of the tank and the height of the tank is very important, not only for the livestock to prevent them to get into the tank, but also to access the cleanest water. So like a horse, if you have it stalled a lot, you don't want that horse in the pen that will kick the wood chips or whatever into the tank, things like that. So make for sure that the water level is at an appropriate height for whatever the animal is. If you've got mixed size livestock together, of course you're going to want to keep the tank where the smallest animal can access it, which means the larger animals might be able to over access it. So that's something that needs to be managed, and maybe some separation of the larger animals and smaller animals.
All right. Well, we are at the top of the hour here. We've got more coming up at 8 o'clock, and we'll talk to Kitty as well. And if we want to talk any more about tanks, we can squeeze that in as well.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. We'll be back with more from the Wildcat Extension District about 8:10. First, we've got news coming up here on the Mighty 690. We're back here on the Mighty 690 in the 7 o'clock hour. We talked about stock tanks. And in the 8 o'clock hour, we've got Kenny Dotson, and he's talking about, did you say diseases?
Diseases. Yes. Very fun topic,
boom,
I know.
Boom, boom.
Kind of sounds scary, but the thing is, for the most part, a lot of these spring diseases we're looking at, we're going to be looking at fungus and fungi, of course, because what do fungi love? Fungi love moist or humidity, and they also love warm temperatures. So usually springtime is around when we're seeing that. I know we're going to see a few colder temperatures, so maybe things will actually slow down this spring and not happen all at once because it's so hot all of a sudden. But usually, like anytime it's above 65, 75, close to the 80s, is when we're going to start seeing some disease issues on our plants, because as soon as the leaves are moist or humid and they're a little warm, that fungus just tends to go off. And so the typical ones we usually see, or we're usually worried about, are going to be some rust diseases, and that can also be similar for wheat. But of course, I'm not a wheat guy. Wheat kind of also tends to get their rusts more concerningly in like late spring into summer, was when their big wheat scare happens. But our spring crops, like our apples, and also peaches get some leaf diseases as well. And another big one is actually going to be sycamore anthracnose. bigger words. All these kind of have big words or some kind of scientific name. But we'll start off with Sycamore anthracnose. So, like I mentioned, it's a foliar disease. It affects their leaves. It's also going to be a fungal disease, which means usually when you think of fungal diseases, how do we treat, how do we prevent them? Fungicides. I will say for this first one, Sycamore anthracnose, not going to be something you really treat for, just because it's really hard to cover an entire tree with fungicide, unless you know a sprayer or you're a trained sprayer. It's just really hard. And also, for the most part, a lot of foliar diseases just kind of impact the plant health. They don't, you know, kill the entire plant. They don't kill all your crops, like apple or peach stuff we'll talk about in a minute. So that's Sycamore anthracnose. Typically appears around now, usually goes away in the summer, so I'd expect it to go away around May. And like I said, it's a foliar disease. So typically for most leaf spots or leaf funguses, they'll either like make different discolorations, different leaf spots. They usually have their own pattern, essentially, and the Sycamore anthracnose is going to be pretty much on the leaf veins. So if you think about like a sycamore leaf, kind of big, kind of palm shaped, like with 5 points, and it's going to have leaf veins going from those points, essentially. Those veins are usually going to be darkened, sometimes soft, and just look unhealthy. Typically, you won't see the leaves until they're on the ground, which always scares people because they'll see their sycamore tree starts to shed all their leaves. And they're really concerned for it because it looks like it's, you know, dying or defoliating or turning into fall when it's the middle of spring and it should be growing. I always tell people, okay, that's Sycamore anthracnose. You can tell by the leaves. If the leaf veins are dark and kind of brown or black and it looks a little bit scary, no big deal. It's actually just a fungus and it shed its leaves. The good thing about those deciduous trees are they can deciduate. They can lose their leaves and put on new buds and regrow from there. Problems with like evergreens, you know, where they only grow from their tips and they don't often grow from behind on the branch, they'll usually defoliate and really not fill in well. But a sycamore, I tell them, okay, all the leaves are down. I'm so sorry for that. But just know if it doesn't bud out, then that's your concern. If it does bud out like it should, you're A-okay. It'll put on new leaves. It looks amazing. And that's going to be one where you really don't treat it. You just notice it, kind of get worried, and then let it regrow. It can, of course, impact the tree's health, like some of the ones I'm going to mention upcoming. When a tree loses its leaves or a plant loses its leaves, obviously that's going to impact photosynthesis. That'll really hurt the overall health of the plant. But if it's still putting on new growth, if it's still not an already unhealthy tree, it should do okay. It should come out of it just fine. But when you get to things like your apple trees and your peach trees, some of those things can be a bit more concerning because you're also worried about the fruits developing on them. We'll talk about peaches first, just because we like peaches. We want to grow peaches in Kansas, but it's not the best climate for peaches, but we can grow them pretty well. I think peaches are pretty great in Oklahoma, so if you're down there listening to this, good for you. Kansas, it's a little bit harder, sometimes because of our winters, sometimes because of our humidity, but that usually that peach disease that we're worried about most right now is another fungus. It's going to be peach leaf curl, and that's typically when you're going to see those peach leaves kind of long. They get these little bumps on them, little bumps and ridges, and they start to fold in on themselves in a way that ends up curling up the leaf. They also usually turn pink as well. And so peach leaf curl is going to be a fungus, once again, that affects the leaves, makes that discoloration, kind of makes bumps and curls up the leaf. But that's going to be one that you're really going to want to spray for fungicide. It doesn't really impact the fruit as much, but of course, the more you impact the leaves, the more you impact the fruit and the overall health of the tree. That's going to be something you really want to spray early, because it's best to get a fungicide on a plant early, because they're only preventative. They only stop an infection from happening. They only prevent the establishment of that fungus. Fungicides usually, almost always, are never a kill all. They don't actually kill the fungus. They don't actually stop any damage from already happening. They just prevent it from infesting. So the peach leaf curl is going to be the big one for peach right now. And then apple trees. This is the big one. This is the fun one, especially if you're a big plant disease nerd like I am. For apple rust, one of the big ones we look at, the first thing you want to do is go over to a cedar tree, probably your eastern red cedar, and just take a look at that tree. Maybe you don't like it. Maybe Wendy has some opinions about that.
Cut it down.
You could also cut it down. That'd be a great job. But there's always more cedar trees, and that's the problem. And so for apple rust, like a lot of the other rusts, like the wheat rusts, It sounds like it's an apple disease, but it really has two different hosts. Almost all rusts, except for one I might talk about later, have an alternate host. That's just how they reproduce. They'll have one host that, you know, overwinters, and they'll put on stuff that puts out spores that affect the apple, or they affect the wheat crop. But the actual crop that you care about just has the leaf problems in spring and summer. So that apple is going to have an alternate host, the apple rust is going to have an alternate host of cedar trees. And so those cedar trees are going to, right around now, develop this little weird kind of brain-shaped, gray, basketball, ugly thing. And also with all the weather we've had recently, with the wet temperatures, those little nasty, dark apple ball things, they're going to start to ooze orange jelly.
Mm-hmm. They're gross. Just cut the whole cedar tree down.
They're really gross, but they look so kind of cool if you just know. It's a fungus. It's nothing that's too scary. But they look like this nasty orange gelatinous thing. And those things, those telial horns, are going to be that part of the reproductive process that puts out spores that infect your apple trees. And so it's actually called cedar apple rust, but we just think about it as apple rust. Matt's right now pulling up images of those on his computer, and they look pretty gross, don't they?
Yeah, I had to see what it looked like. I've seen the
brain.
Yeah, it kind of gets hollow or whatever. Mm-hmm. I've never seen the jelly-looking substance. So.
Yep, right around now is when we're going to start, you know, getting all that moisture, getting ready to put out more spores, and they just turn into this nasty gelatinous mess. And eventually they'll start to infect your apple trees. Apple and pear, just because the rust is pretty... sticks to most of the things in that family. So apple and pear, quince can also get it, but quince rust is a little bit different. There's also cedar hawthorn rust, but for the most part, anything that's kind of causing those rust makes orange spots, hence why it's called rust. So if you're starting to see those orange spots on your apple, maybe your pear tree, sometimes it'll also affect the fruit. Usually cedar quince rust will affect the fruit of a plant. Not usually apple, but like calorie pears can get it, and they'll start to put on weird different colors and fungal growths as well. That'll be your cedar apple rust. And it's a very interesting, very nasty, usually not too harmful disease, especially if you can get your stuff sprayed soon. Like I mentioned, if that apple tree starts to defoliate or get covered in rust, it won't produce as well and might not make the right fruits that you want it to make. Apples can also get scab, which is another disease that kind of affects the fruit more. Apple scab tends to actually affect the fruit itself and cause like a scab, essentially. It's like a dark, hard spot on the apple. So those are your fungal diseases for your apples that you really want to look at and care about right now, especially if they're not established, because it's always better to prevent them than try to worry about treating them. Typically for that, you can spray something with myclobutanil. That's going to be your rust fungicide for your apple trees. You could also look at using sulfur and neem oil, or the two like organic fungicides, but myclobutanil is going to be the non-organic trade method. And then lastly, I've got one more rust to talk about that actually doesn't have an alternate host, at least in my research. Hollyhock rust is going on right now. I know our Fredonia office has beautiful hollyhocks mm-hmm. outside. If you're at the courthouse, check them out. They're usually beautiful, and I have seen some flower buds already, so I'm excited for them. But I've also seen some hollyhock rust on them. Just like that apple rust, they're going to have a whole bunch of orange yellowish dots all over them. They're also going to make a spot on the back side, which most rusts do this. They'll have, you know, the spot you see on the top that you're really concerned about, but then the back side they'll start to blister a little bit, and also make more little structures where they release their spores back onto their alternate host. However, hollyhocks don't tend to have an alternate host, or the hollyhock rust doesn't. They tend to just infect themselves. And so for a lot of things like that, when you think about how do I treat this, you know, fungal disease, or like my tomatoes, they'll get a leaf blotch later, septoria leaf spot in the summer. When you think about, okay, this crop has this problem and it always comes up, and maybe it doesn't have an alternate host, what do you do? Usually the best control is a sanitation method, which means plucking out those nasty, dirty, infected leaves, burning them ideally. You wouldn't want to try to compost them just because you can't guarantee they'll go away. And just getting rid of them. Trash or burn, likely burn, and that'll actually reduce the load of that pathogen in the area, and hopefully reduce infections as well.
So can just anybody spray these fungicides on trees or things, or do they have to get somebody that's in the business?
So a lot of things are restricted use, but anything you find on a shelf in a store, like if you see a spray, usually neem oil and sulfur compounds are usually homeowner rated. Myclobutanil, I think there's some homeowner rated mixes, but if you find them in your Home Depot, your Walmart, your garden section, that'll be something you can use. You can also look on greenbook.net and just to see if there's any restricted use sprays. I mentioned myclobutanil. That's the ingredient name, not the trade name. So I can't tell you specific trade names because we're not supposed to sponsor anyone or advertise any specific product. But if you can find it on your shelf, you can use that product. And then if you can't find it on your shelf, maybe call someone who can spray trees.
All right. Well, can you over-treat? I'm kind of bad about doing stuff like that. Well,
You're like, I
want to take care of the problem, and you just dump the whole thing on there. You don't really read the instructions.
Yeah, so one of the hardest things you can do for a plant, especially when you're spraying it, typically if it's something like really harsh, it can affect it. Most of these things, like a fungicide, isn't usually too bad. The most important thing is to look on the label to see if there's any photosensitivity, because a lot of times if you spray a plant, especially if you're trying to cover it completely to prevent any infection, sometimes the covering of the leaf plus any sunlight can actually burn the plant or have some kind of phototoxic response, and that's usually on the label as well. It'll tell you, don't spray this when, or sometimes they'll also have like a pre-harvest interval. So if you're spraying your apples for your rust, you don't want them to, you know, be covered in your spray by the time you're ready to harvest. So the label will have a post-harvest date. If it is restricted use, they'll probably also have a restricted re-entry where no one should be around it just because of toxicity issues. But also phototoxicity would be on the label as well.
And I assume the label will also mention, or maybe you'll know, if it affects other, like, plants or other, like if your trees are near something else, your crops or whatever,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's an effect there as well.
It would say what it's toxic to, and it'd also say other things it's listed for. So some things are only listed for certain species. Some things can be affected on other species too. Read the label. Always read the label.
When in doubt,
I always tell people, just please read your label or tell me what you have so I can read your label for you.
Yes, the label is the law, and that's not just a phrase that we say. It's actually the law, so it's legally binding. So mm-hmm. The label is the law.
That's good. I like that. Label is the law. That's good to remember. So, all right, anything else you want to hit on as far as disease go?
No, we could plug some more dates if you've got the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, why don't you recap what we talked about, the 7 o'clock hour at the top with everything you got going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So our cow camp still has a few spots open, and that's going to take place May 5th and 6th in Parsons. So sign up, take a look at our social media pages, our website, or call one of our offices.
Absolutely. And then the Nuisance Wildlife Control will be at the Southeast Research Extension Center just outside of Parsons, May 9th. Starts at 9 a.m. That one's not at the Research Center. That one's at our brand new Independence Building at 712 West Myrtle. That one's May 9th, 9 a.m., Nuisance Wildlife, new indie building. The one at the Research Center is going to be the Spring Crops Field Day come May 19th. That's where we're going to look at all those interesting intercropping, alfalfa, grain bin stuff, but also the big hitter is the wheat plot tours, just to see what's going and growing and going on well. May 19th, Southeast Research Extension Center. And then my big plug is going to be the two plant-to-plate camps still open are Independence and Altamont. Independence is June 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. Altamont is June 9th, 10th, and 11th. It's only $15. Your kids get to learn how to cook. They get to hopefully find some new favorite recipes. Wendy's kids last year found some favorite recipes. And they also get to take home a plant. So eventually they can cook their own plant.
All right. And then we got cow camp.
Yes, cow camp May 5th and 6th in Parsons. Sign up for that. It's geared towards the ladies in the cattle industry. We're looking forward to that program. So our extension office, Altamont, can be reached at 620-784-5337. And the Independence phone number is 620-331-2690.
And just to remind you, that location will be changing soon. Mm-hmm. Hopefully by May 31st, we will absolutely be in the new building. We have that open house on May 13th as well. Mm-hmm. That's 712 West Myrtle. It's a whole big block between Myrtle and Laurel, between, I think, 14th and 13th Street.
Yep. It's near the helicopter pad of the old hospital. Mm-hmm. Most folks know where that's at.
All right. Well, thanks for both coming in, and we'll talk to someone from the Wildcat Extension District next week.
Yep. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
All right. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.